Welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'll try to explain why these things have happened and what it means to you and me. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God in accordance with the terms and conditions of His coordinate, of His covenant by way of His Torah teachings. If you're an agnostic or an atheist, or if you're someone who knows there's something not quite right with your religion, this will be the best part of today's program. Our number, should you wish to call and question, even affirm or criticize anything you've heard me say, is 877-300-7645. Now on to the news. This morning we heard that the U.S. Defense Department and Israel are making all sorts of sounds like, "We have just a wonderful friendship and a loving and close relationship," and that nothing says love more than more military hardware. The reality is exactly the opposite of what was said, but that's not uncommon amongst politicians. It doesn't matter if those politicians are American or Israeli or if from any other part of the world. The rhetoric between America and Israel has this tendency to say we are the bestest of friends, that the bonds between our countries will never be broken. But the reality is, both with the Defense Department, the State Department, and also with this administration, there is no bond between Israel and the United States. It's shattered. America, particularly at the State Department, the Defense Department, and in the White House, has been anti-Israel for a very long time. We are the primary motivation for Israel giving up the West Bank. We're the country that forced Israel to give up Gaza. There is a prophetic passage in Yeshayah, which is Isaiah 17 and 18. It uses some 12 to 13 adjectives to describe a nation that could only be the United States based upon these descriptions. And it accuses this nation of thinning Israel at the waist and of looting Israel of its land, which is precisely what the United States has done by forcing Israel to give up Gaza and now compelling Israel to give up the West Bank. It will make the nation only 10 miles wide at its waist, where 60 to 70% of the people live. When that is accomplished, what we will end up with is the same kind of catalyst to World War III that we ended up with as a catalyst to World War II when Neville Chamberlain gave the high ground of Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler. From a defense point of view, we have been equally harsh on Israel as has been the State Department in condemning Israel even building homes in the West Bank. On the defense side, the United States is now sending almost 25 times more military hardware to Israel's enemies than it is to Israel. So in the past, Israel received more American military might than did her foes. Today, that has been reversed to the tune of 25 to 1. We recently signed an agreement to sell the Saudis, for example, $70 billion worth of advanced weaponry. And even on the side of the equation where Israel is able to buy American weapons, we're now selling them the ultimate pig in the poke. The Joint Strike Fighter is the latest deal. That's an airplane that is so expensive and so poorly conceived that the United States still hasn't received any, and we postponed the building of the first 127 for the United States, which was a fraction of the original commitment, out another year. It is the ultimate boondoggle. But to salvage the contract with the defense contractors the United States is doing its best to convince Great Britain and Israel, even Japan, to buy this pig. Speaking of pigs, the Fed is going to announce that it will maintain interest rates at virtually no interest at all, and that it is still looking at quantitative easing. The likelihood of additional quantitative easing is high. What that essentially means is we will continue to inflate the monetary supply. The Fed has stopped reporting M3, which is its increases to monetary supply, because it does not want the average person to know how destructive they have been in terms of the value of the currency. But the fact remains that other than blind patriotic faith, the American currency is worthless. It is nothing but a fiat debt instrument, and it has been so inflated with the printing of additional money that we've destroyed its value. But we are not the only country struggling with leaders who do not have the public's interest in mind. We turn to Syria, where Syrian helicopter gunships, these would be not Syrian gunships, as it's reported here, they would be Russian gunships. Syria does not make helicopter gunships, but Russia does, and has recently shipped a new supply to Syria. They and artillery, also Russian, pounded two key areas of Aleppo on Tuesday. The reason that we should be concerned about Aleppo is that it is the largest of the Syrian cities. Extending the army's campaign to control the country's biggest city, but rebel fighters have said that troops loyal to President Bashar al-Assad had been forced to retreat. One of the things that you know when you're reading a story of a battle in Islam is that you're going to get lots of bragging and very little factual information. One of the great examples is that Muslims will tell you that Muhammad was a great general, and that that the reason that Muhammad fought battles is because, you know, great armies sought to oppose him, and that through his leadership and God's support, he was able, in defensive battles, to defeat those who would destroy him and his message. The opposite is true. Muhammad never fought an army, never once, never even fought an organized militia. All of his battles, if you want to even call them battles, were either against caravanners who were just merchants, you know, guys walking alongside camels carrying their goods to market, or farmers. He never once engaged any actual military foe. And each time that he would engage in one of these terrorist raids, there would be great legend and lore over the ability of the Muslim to slaughter, to kidnap, to enslave, to steal. And that was the entire motivation even then. Muhammad said that not only is stealing lawful and good, but so long as those Muslims fighting on his behalf as terrorists gave 20% of the total booty to him, they could keep the rest. And that is why they fought. A rebel commander in Aleppo said his fighter's aim was to push towards the city center, a district-by-district, a goal that he believed that he could achieve within days, if not weeks. Highly unlikely, but wishful thinking and bragging has always been part of Islam. And I personally received over 1,000 death threats by Muslims for having written Prophet of Doom, which is the most comprehensive, the best documented, most contextual, and complete presentation of Islam's 5 oldest books ever compiled. And the threats are all explicit. They are all braggadocious. And yet, that is the end of it. The regime, this is a quote, has tried for 3 days to regain Saladin, but attempts have failed, and it has suffered heavy losses in human life and weapons and tanks, and it has been forced to withdraw, said Colonel Abdul Jabbar al-Kaduki, the head of the Joint Military Council and one of the rebel groups in Aleppo. It has not been possible, this is now from Reuters, it has not been possible to verify independently who controls this Saladin, a district that lies on a major road that the army could use to bring reinforcements into the city. Another one of the factors that always exists anytime we begin to speak about Islam and mayhem existing in Islamic countries is that there is no free press. Freedom of speech does not exist in Islam. If a person in an Islamic country says anything critical of the repulsive prophet known as Muhammad, the man who was a rapist, incestuous, pedophile, mass-murdering thug, if you were to properly report on what the oldest Islamic scriptures have to say about him, you will be killed. Muhammad, when the first journalist of his day, now he was illiterate, his companions were illiterate, so the first journalists of his day were poets. When these poets were to expose Muhammad accurately, saying that he was a complete fraud, Muhammad would always have his henchmen go off and kill them, silencing the voice of criticism. And even during those raids, the first thing that Muhammad would tell his mujahideen that were going off to assassinate the reporter, the journalist, is that if they needed to deceive them, if they needed to lie to make the victim easier prey, that they were exonerated in doing so. And so when we have reports from the Islamic world, we know that the likelihood of accuracy is extremely low. Now, the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that more than 100 people, 73 of them civilians, were killed just on Monday of this week. It said that 5 rebel fighters died during the clashes in Saladin. Well, we've come to the end of the first segment of Shattering Myths. We'll return to another story, this one also on Syria, after the break. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. Should you wish to engage in this conversation, our number is 877-300-7645. Right before we went to break, we were concluding the first of several articles that I wanted to share with you this morning on the battle in Syria. One of the things that was interesting, though, is that yesterday I had the opportunity to talk to a Syrian exile. He happens to be a Syrian Christian, which is why he is probably a Syrian exile. And, you know, his point of view was that Assad wasn't all that bad, and the civil war wasn't all that bad, and the civil war had nothing to do with democracy or freedom fighting. And it was interesting because the Christian community, small as it may be, in Syria is almost universally pro-Assad. And you would think, well, Christianity is based upon free will, and why would they embrace a dictator, particularly a dictator as ruthless as Assad? Well, it's the same reason that the Christian community, small as it may have been in Iraq, embraced Saddam Hussein and did not appreciate it when America invaded Iraq and gave the country over to fundamentalist Shia Muslims in Tehran. Since that has happened, the Christian community in Iraq has been annihilated. Their churches have been burned, their homes have been looted, and they have been killed. And the same thing will happen in Syria if the fundamentalist Muslims, this time now Sunni Muslims, if they were to prevail and overthrow Assad, the small remnant of Christian churches, their homes, and their very lives will be destroyed. And they know it. But it is kind of amazing that once the United States invaded Iraq, the conditions for Christians deteriorated so severely that they were essentially annihilated as a community. Well, here's our second story from Syria. This is from CNN. It says, in just a few months, Syria's rebels have transformed themselves from a ragtag village defense force into an armed movement capable of attacking the country's two largest cities, Aleppo and Damascus. Now they are bracing themselves for what one Syrian newspaper has called the mother of all battles. Once again, exaggeration and pompous attitudes prevail in the world of Islam. Both the rebels and the regime are building up their manpower in and around Aleppo, Syria's largest city, where the rebels have made inroads this past week. The fighting, as you know, has already begun. Ahmed Afa, a rebel squad leader based in Anadan, a rebel-controlled town 6 miles north of Aleppo, said, "We started out this struggle with rocks. Now they have rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, assault rifles, and 50-caliber machine guns." Here is his quote. "I have fired this gun about 2,000 times, said rebel Jamal Awar, referring to the double-barreled anti-aircraft gun on the top of a truck. Awar, a former bus driver, said that he shot down a helicopter several weeks ago with the gun. Now, the reason that that story is important is because what was once a group of underrepresented people, which is typical in the Islamic world, the majority of the people in Syria are Sunni Muslims, were trying to peacefully protest the enforcement of Shia influence over them, because the Alawite government is Shia. But the Saudi Arabians, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, the Bahrainis, the heads of those fiefdoms, being uncomfortable with what has happened in the Islamic world, with the United States having toppled Saddam Hussein, a Sunni, and given that country to the Shias in Tehran, in Iran, have seen this as an opportunity for a proxy war. And that is what is occurring now. We have extremely well-equipped rebels that have been equipped by these Sunni dictators surrounding Syria, which is kind of funny. You know, this notion that the freedom fighters are trying to topple a dictator. Well, all of their weapons have come from dictators. And now we have a civil war. And this civil war is extraordinarily important for what's going to happen over the next 15 years as Sunni and Shia Islam fight for control of the religion. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics. Our number, should you wish to engage in this conversation, is 877-300-7645. Returning to a third story now on Syria, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which compiles reports of anti-Assad activities, said that 1,261 people had been killed across Syria just in the last few days. This made this by far the bloodiest partial week in the uprising that has now claimed at least 18,000 lives, and many think now over 20,000 lives. It makes this uprising almost as deadly as the previous one in Syria, where Assad's father destroyed an entire town. For those that don't know, the last time there was a rebellion like this in Syria to dissuade the Sunni Muslims from seeking to have any influence in their government, Assad's father surrounded a town of 30,000 people. He then began to shell it. He then flew his bombers and aircraft over it, gunning it. And after he had firebombed it, he turned his bulldozers loose on it and made it a mass grave. Over 30,000 men, women, and children, all unarmed, were savaged over the course of a week. And so at this point, this is not the largest battle of its kind in Syria. One thing, though, that we should mention is that there is this constant scream, like the shriek of nails across a blackboard, that is constantly coming out of the Islamic world, talking about how horrible the oppression is of the Muslims in Israel, and how these so-called Palestinians are mistreated and they don't have any say in their government. Of course, the opposite is true. That is the nature of propaganda. The opposite is true. The Muslims living in Israel have complete voting rights and the same rights as do Jews living in Israel. It's one of the few countries of its kind in the world where there is no discrimination based upon race or religion. But the opposite is true, and this is what makes it so interesting. The opposite is true throughout the Islamic world. For example, the largest actual genetic group of people, where a group can be identified racially that does not have a homeland and that is constantly oppressed, is the Kurds. There is no genetic tie on what's called the so-called Palestinian people. They're just a blend of Muslims from around the Middle East. There is absolutely no such thing as a Palestinian people, but there absolutely is such a thing as the Kurds. There are 30 million of them. And the Kurds live in eastern Turkey, where they are treated like animals. They live in northern Iraq. They live in northwestern Iran. And for centuries, the Kurds have fought for some autonomy. They are the largest indigenous people without any country to call their own. And they are routinely oppressed by the Muslim dictatorships that occupy their lands. And so when you hear this screech by the Muslim world on how the so-called Palestinians, who are an invented people, don't have their own homeland and how it has to be carved out of Israel, you don't hear anyone complain that there are 30 million ethnic Kurds that have been denied a homeland by the Muslims. It's kind of like when Obama lectured Netanyahu on how he had to give up the West Bank and demeaned him and said, you need to go back to the 1967 lines in Israel. And Obama said, sure, I'll be glad to do that as soon as the United States goes back to the 13 original colonies. After all, did you not take all the rest of it by fighting the indigenous people? Now, in your case, Mr. President, you were the aggressor. You were the aggressor all the way across in your manifest destiny, stealing land. We were never the aggressor. The reason that we now have more room in this country is because those who wished to annihilate us in 1948, and again with the Six-Day War, and again with the Yom Kippur War, lost those wars. And so it is just pure hypocrisy that the Islamic world would scream about the treatment of Muslims in Israel and continue to harass their own people. And here, even in Syria, we find exactly the same thing, which is the majority of the people are being oppressed by a minority government. It was, by the way, just another, speaking of hypocrisy, it's kind of an interesting aside here. Assad, who is now considered, you know, the great warmonger of the world, it was just a couple of years ago that Hillary Clinton proclaimed that Assad was a man that we can work with. Turning to another dark place in the Islamic world, this is from the Associated Press. The dateline is Baghdad. The story here is tries to create the myth that Al-Qaeda is the source of all of the killing in Iraq, so that it is appropriate for us to continue to wage a mythical war against Al-Qaeda. But you'll hear them stumble all over themselves in this story. Al-Qaeda is, in essence, nothing. The problem is fundamentalist Islam. But here's the story. It says, so far this summer, militants linked to Al-Qaeda have claimed responsibility for a steady drumbeat of attacks designed to keep the government off balance as it works to overcome a power struggle that pits Sunnis and Kurdish leaders against the Shiite prime minister. Every bit of that is untrue. There are no militant groups linked to Al-Qaeda. When we raided Osama bin Laden's lair in Pakistan, one of the things that we very quickly recognized is that the three Islamic groups that use his name as a franchise do not listen to him, do not take directions from him, and have no association with the Al-Qaeda that America originally went to do battle with. At all. And that it's the full extent is the commonality of the name, because the name became popular. But there is no linking to Al-Qaeda. Plus the fact Al-Qaeda does not have a ideology. Al-Qaeda does not have a independent mission. Al-Qaeda doesn't even have any independent leadership. Al-Qaeda is simply a fundamentalist Islamic group. 100% of their inspiration comes from Muhammad and Allah. It is derived from the Hadith and the Quran. This myth that these militants are linked to Al-Qaeda is creating a fictional enemy. They are all linked to fundamentalist Islam. The second part of that, they have no desire to keep the government off balance, and the government isn't seeking to overcome a power struggle. Those thoughts aren't even germane to this discussion. All the Sunnis are trying to do is to attack Shias, and they're attacking Shias because the Shias are now attacking them. And it is the same situation that we see in Syria, where the two versions of Islam are at one another's throat. And there is no attempt by the present government, if you can even call it that, of Iraq, to incorporate other voices into its mix. They want one thing, which is now the government in Tehran, the mullahs in Tehran, have absolute control over Iraq, and they're not about to give it up. That's what we created with our invasion. Going on with the article, it says, in a statement issued Saturday on a militant website, al-Baghdadi warned that his Islamic State of Iraq is returning to strongholds that it was driven from by the American military. This ISI, this Islamic State of Iraq, is the actual name of the group linked to Al-Qaeda. So, there is, and I studied the first 5 years of the Iraq invasion. I actually chronicled the actually what happened that led to the deaths of every American that died there in the first 4 to 5 years of that conflict. And I also documented every terrorist attack that occurred in Iraq in the 5 years leading up to the American invasion and in the 5 years after the American invasion. And I can tell you that the Islamic State of Iraq was a terrorist group comprised of Sunni Muslims that came to exist principally because the Shiite brigades from Sadr were terrorizing Sunni Muslim communities. And so the Islamic State of Iraq came into being principally to defend themselves from the Shia militias and secondarily to attack and kill Americans. There was no presence of Iraq in of Al-Qaeda in Iraq within the first 2 years following the American invasion. And there had been no presence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the 5 years prior to the American invasion. And so here is an Islamic terrorist group called the Islamic State of Iraq. And to create the myth that we are fighting Al-Qaeda and that Al-Qaeda exists, we have renamed it, we, not they, have renamed it this Islamic State of Iraq, Al-Qaeda. And now we say that it is linked to Al-Qaeda because we have given it a new name. The article goes on to say, at its peak, Al-Qaeda in Iraq brutalized its victims. No, Al-Qaeda in Iraq didn't. The Islamic State in Iraq brutalized its victims with publicized beheadings, suicide bombings, and roadside bombs. We'll return to this story after the break and continue to try to understand what's actually happening to create the mayhem in Iraq. This is Shattering Myths, 877-300-7645. Welcome back to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. One of the reasons that I think it's important that we discuss issues like those occurring in Iraq, where the Islamic State of Iraq, which is a fundamentalist Sunni terrorist organization, has been misclassed as Al-Qaeda, is for you to understand that the entire war against terror is a mythological conflict. This war against terror, and you cannot fight a war against terror because terror is a tactic. It's a tactic the United States has used many times. The North won the Civil War through the imposition of terror. Sherman's March to the Sea was a terrorist strategy. We ultimately prevailed in the Pacific theater of World War II by being terrorists. We firebombed Japanese cities, killing as many as 50,000 women and children a night for some 50 straight nights. Terror is a very common tactic, but you can't fight a war against terror. And so this has become a mythological war. And now to give the terrorists a name, the United States and many of willing media accomplices around the world have decided that why don't we just relabel Islam Al-Qaeda? And we'll differentiate Al-Qaeda from Islam, and we'll, rather than saying that the terrorists that that we are attacking or the terrorists who are bombing are linked to Islam, which is the only thing that connects all of these fundamentalist Islamic organizations, we'll say that they are linked to Al-Qaeda, and we'll create this myth that somehow Al-Qaeda has created its own agenda, that it has its own philosophy that other organizations buy into, and that it's an umbrella for a strategy that now comprises an actual enemy. And none of that is true. But when a country can beguile its people into thinking it's fighting a war, even if that war is completely mythological, then it can steal its money, its citizens' money, It can rob its citizens of freedom. Its citizens will rally around and support governments that are corrupt and acting in a manner that is inappropriate for the well-being of its citizens. A country can invade Iraq, which was suicidal for the United States, and most Americans will rally around the flag and say how wonderful it was what we did in Iraq when we gave Iraq to Iran so that Iran could complete its nuclear program, which bombs which will be deployed in the United States. We invaded Afghanistan, and we pushed the fundamentalist Muslims out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, a country that has nuclear weapons, where those very same Muslims are destabilizing that country. It was obvious that it was suicidal as well. But when you create this myth of war, people stop thinking, they start being patriotic, they are willing to sacrifice their freedoms, they're willing to tolerate evil rulers, evil administrations. They are willing to accept lies on behalf of this war. And so that is why they do it. And to a large extent, administrations, presidents do it. George Bush did it to be a wartime president because they know that they become ever more popular by doing so. But I'm here to tell you that if you were to take as few as 10 hours, you can learn the truth for yourself. If you're willing to invest 50 hours, you can read Prophet of Doom. It's at prophetofdoom.net. It is the most comprehensive, the best documented, most chronological and comprehensive presentation of Islam's five earliest religious sources, putting the Quran into the context of Muhammad's life by using the hadith. And by doing so, you will understand that to be a good Muslim, you have to be a terrorist. All good Muslims are jihadists. And once you understand that, then you will understand who is killing whom and why. And that understanding puts you in an entirely superior position as it relates to knowing what's going to happen in our world and understanding why it is happening. You won't be subject to the beguiling nature of politicians and the media. Returning to this article, it reads, at its peak, Al-Qaeda in Iraq brutalized its victims, and we hear now about these beheadings and bombings and the roadside bombs, none of which were perpetrated by Al-Qaeda, all of which were perpetrated by just fundamentalist Islamic groups that had congregated in Iraq. This is Shattering Myths, 877-300-7645.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a